Today on Movie Wallahs, we continue our coverage of the Tribeca Film Festival 2019. Time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, Dee as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings, all.
Another great day at Tribeca.
Yes.
Indeed, yes. We have a few fewer movies to catch up on today than we did yesterday, as I think we alluded to at the first day of our coverage. We're not going so crazy this year trying to see every five different movies a piece each day. So we saw five movies today in between helpings of dumplings.
More dumplings.
And white moustache yogurt. So we're doing our usual indulgent thing of, when in New York, eat dumplings. And mighty fine dumplings we find in the city.
Yes.
Movie Wallahs is brought to you today by Vanessa's Dumplings,
which are ridiculous.
They're just good.
Ridiculous. They're too good. They shouldn't exist. We don't deserve them.
Yeah, there's a couple of...
Rashmi thinks we do.
No, I'm just kind of like, I can't believe we've had the dumplings 2 days in a row.
I could have them again.
Well, we can. We can try excellent dumplings tomorrow.
Yes, there are many, many dumplings around... New York, but we had them with chives, we had them with shrimp.
We had them pan-fried, we had them boiled.
And they're such a wonderful food group, dumplings.
They are. So
like, I think they ought to be kind of required in the food pyramid.
Yes.
But nonetheless, we have Instagrammed our dumplings, so do check out our Instagram feed. We haven't been very diligent about that lately, but we will try and Instagram a couple of things from the film festival. So Instagram.com/MovieWallahs. If you don't already follow us, do follow us there. Okay, five movies to talk about today, so I'll stop there with the banter. We're going to talk about the movies Crown Vic, Circus of Books, Run, Almis, and A Taste of Sky. So those are the movies that we managed to see today. Why don't we get started and do them in that order? So let's start with the movie Crown Vic.
Okay, so we all saw this one. This is a directorial debut by Joel Souza. And this really follows two police officers played by Thomas Jane and Luke Kleintank. Thomas Jane you will recognize from the program Hung that came on HBO, where he kind of played a gigolo of sorts. Here he is playing a cop at the end of his career, whilst Luke Kleintank is kind of first day on the job. And the film really follows them around one night shift in the Olympic division of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So what did you guys think of this? So Yazdi, why don't you kick us off?
So this movie, for all its faults, has one thing going for it, which is that it seems to be reacting to a shot of adrenaline the whole running time. So this is a movie which is ostensibly about one night of patrol in the dark streets of Los Angeles with an experienced cop and a rookie cop, first day of his job. And the whole movie runs like an adrenalized, like somebody was literally shocking you through the whole runtime. So it's very watchable from that perspective. I have some issues with it, but we can talk more.
Joe?
I mean, this movie is very reminiscent of the David Ayer type movies, which include Training Day, and End of Watch. Which are both movies that I admire a lot. So this kind of material is kind of right up my alley. Like you, Yazdi, I think the movie has a couple of faults, but that didn't stop me enjoying it. I will say that, this is quite a night. In fact, I wrote down, in my notes, oh, what a night, because there were so many little events that happened. It was like an entire season of cops crammed into kind of an evening on the beat. So it felt a little compressed from a timeline perspective, but that didn't stop me enjoying it for what it was. It was a very well crafted movie, well edited, shot, directed, and acted. So I like this one.
Yeah, I described this as Training Day Light. I think this has really got some great acting in it. And Thomas Jane just blew me away.
You know, I didn't recognize him from Hung. That was the great observation there, Rashmi.
Yeah, so I love the pacing. I agree with everything the two of you said. Again, I keep kind of describing these movies as a little bit overcooked at the edges. And it's a tiny bit predictable. But I love the premise. I love the premise of someone at the end of their career looking back and kind of knowing what's right and wrong, and someone being so idealistic and wanting to do what's right versus wrong. So I think that interplay is so good. And I like that it's not judging, but it's kind of looking at, you know, again, this idea of what's real versus ideal. Really love this movie.
So yeah, you mentioned a couple issues with the movie.
Yeah, so I think it kind of plays it like almost a march through horrors. Like it goes through like, you know, one horrific event after another. And there's these musical interludes which play between them, you know, like you've just seen like a vaudeville act, you know, like da-da-da-da-da, something horrifying plays out, and then there's this music, and then it goes on to the next event. So it almost seems to trivialize the whole situation a little bit.
Kind of little vignettes.
They're kind of
with a loose narrative.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other big issue I had with the movie is that it really plays mental health for humor far too many times for my comfort. There's a lot of people in this movie that they apprehend and that they run into who are clearly mentally unstable, and it kind of uses them for humor repeatedly. And I don't know, it didn't jar well with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, maybe that's the statement of what's happening in our communities, right? There's people who are, you know, not under the care of or supervision of what used to be health institutions. I don't know. I don't think it's being that political.
I was going to say, I don't think it's necessarily a social commentary. It's kind of introducing what it believes to be a typical scenario that is faced by the LA cops as they go around. I mean, you know, there's lots of ways to poke holes in this movie. And in particular, I think, you know, if I was to try and find fault, I would say, you know, number one, the movie has no redeeming female or non-white characters. You know, they're
at all.
At all. I mean, I think
no characters of color, yeah, who are redeeming. Yes.
So, you know, I think its structure is interesting in that it does go to the effort of punctuating each of these little stories with a kind of a freeze frame and a title card and a timestamp of what time it was in the evening. And I feel like if you'd gone to that effort, then you could have made this story play out over the course of a week or a couple of weeks or a month or something like that, and not detracted at all from any of the messaging that the movie had. So it was always a little distracting to think, wow, what a night. You know, you've picked up a drunk, you've solved a crime, and all the time these are constant trips back to the station. They wash the police car. There's an extraordinary amount of events packed into one night. But nonetheless, I thought it was great fun. So,
and I think that each event unravels something more about each of the characters.
Oh, for sure.
So it's done in the service of the story, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I still think it's exceptionally entertaining, and it's, like I said, like live wire act the whole time. I just think it didn't do as well at the social commentary pieces. It tries to kind of justify the Thomas Jane character is, you know, horribly, you know,
he's jaded,
but he's also like this hyper toxic, you know, kind of your army sergeant kind of character, and he kind of tries to justify his behavior by quoting George Orwell at one time. And it kind of touches upon, I think it tries to touch upon this whole issue about police brutality. And, you know, it cannot get there because I think that would be a different movie, you know, trying to make a serious commentary on those issues. And when it tries to do that, it kind of seems, you know, at odds with its own direction. But
right. No, the fun nonetheless. And yeah, I look forward to seeing more from the director, because again, I think from a technical perspective, I mean,
it was really well put together.
The opening scene, just in the sound design alone, brilliant. I mean,
the opening scene is brilliant. Yeah.
I wanted to run from the theater because the sound and it placed you right in the square of this, you know, horrific, violent action scene. So.
And it made me feel claustrophobic right away.
Yeah.
I have to say, I said it just now, but Thomas Jane blew me away. There's a lot of facial, again, a lot of acting that's done by facial acting or gesture, body language, and he nails it. The only other criticism I had was he had a bit of a mustache that kept growing and shortening. I don't know if you guys noticed.
No. Yeah,
because initially it looked like one of those little Hitler mustaches.
It was the most unfortunate Hitler mustache. Yeah.
But anyway.
And I think there's a whole parade of, you know, characters that they run into, but I think one who was really memorable is this other quote-unquote corrupt police officer.
Like a vice undercover, yeah.
Yeah, played by Josh Hopkins, who I thought was very memorable.
Yeah.
And you would think, based on this movie, that, you know, Los Angeles was some kind of hell on earth, peopled by these crazy and perverse monsters at every corner, the way it plays out. But again,
Have you ever watched an episode of Cops?
No, I have not. Okay. I just listen to the tune and then I go to bed.
What's interesting is it's produced by Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, let's move along. Movie number two of the day is going to be Circus of Books. And I am going to introduce that very quickly here. I was the only one of us that didn't see that one. So the premise of this sounds fascinating. I think if I had read this log line before making my choice, I may have come along with you. But I'll read it straight from the Tribeca site here. And it says, how do you explain to your friends that your mum and pop run a gay pornography shop? This is just one question that director Rachel Mason asks in this intimate and probing documentary. When their medical device company went under, Karen and Barry Mason needed a source of income to tide them over. They found a temporary gig distributing explicit magazines for publisher Larry Flint. This eventually morphed into a mini adult empire, including the titular retail shop, a fixture on West Hollywood Santa Monica Boulevard for decades, and later a hardcore film production company. I'll stop there. Yeah, fascinating premise, and I didn't realize this was a documentary either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the name obviously is explained by what I just read here. And what did you guys think of Circus of Books?
Yeah, again, look, this is a really initially light and frothy documentary about, done in a very matter-of-fact way, about a really interesting topic. And I think what's most fascinating about this is that, again, it's one of those that tells of a time and gives you a history of kind of the challenges and hurdles that, you know, that the LGBTQ community has faced through time. Mainly the G of the LGBT, or the L and the G. But what I loved about this is that the couple at the center of this, who are the owners of the store, have such an interesting life themselves. And they're such a cute couple that the kind of the talking head part, I mean, she's filming her parents, right? The filmmaker is filming her parents, and they're almost done in that kind of When Harry Met Sally type vignettes of the old people, you know, of the different couples.
Right.
If you love that movie, which I do. So I just think that this is a really interesting way to handle quite sensitive information in a very approachable manner, which is centered around this bookstore. And the bookstore becomes the vehicle then to kind of tell the historical challenges of the community and how important that bookstore became. I really enjoyed this documentary.
Yeah, I loved it. And I think it's one of the few movies which was announced to be playing at Tribeca, which was bought out even before the film festival started. So Netflix has bought it out.
You two will get a chance to see
it. And you will get a chance to see it. And I think Netflix made the right call, because I think the tagline or the premise of the movie, this supposedly very straight and square Jewish couple, you know, in the early 60s.
Where the Jewish mother is fairly religious as well.
Yeah, how they land up becoming at one time the nation's biggest distributor of gay porn. How does that even happen? And this is not made up. This is reality.
This is reality, yeah.
But I think that'll get people to watch the movie. Mm-hmm. But I think what'll keep them when they're watching Netflix is how affectionate the movie is and how good-hearted all of these characters are. So there's obviously the historical element, but I couldn't get enough of the parents. So look, I mean, the movie is a love letter from her daughter to her parents, because at some point, so she and her three brothers, they were never told as kids that that's what their parents did. They ran the store, which originally sold magazines, then it went to DVDs. And then at one point, they were actually making their own, they were financing their own porn movies. So she wants to find out more about it, but it's a love letter to the parents. And the more you learn about these two people, you realize how human and how authentic they are. And my feeling for the parents is similar to what I have for the parents in another very charming documentary, which is also on Netflix right now, Meet the Patels. Remember, yes, we had seen that at LA Film? So how affectionate those parents were, it's kind of the same thing. And I think the movie kind of, in its last act, kind of questions a very interesting dilemma that the mother faces, mm-hmm, and kind of handles it again with a lot of sensitivity. So I think the movie is a winner. I don't see how, you know, unless the concept itself turns some people off, it's just a great way to spend an hour and a half.
Is it family viewing?
Yeah, it's PG-13, I would say, for the most part. There's no, you see is covers of, you know, DVDs, of DVDs, yeah, and stuff, okay, but I mean, there's nothing.
There's a few F-bombs.
Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah.
Okay, no. Clearly the subject matter lends itself to kind of adult themes, but it's not raunchy in any way.
No, it's not smutty. Borderline, you know, it is borderline. I don't know if I'd want to watch it with my 13-year-old, but you know, I think what's really interesting is that the filmmaker actually becomes one of the characters in the movie.
Okay,
that's my only sort of. It's a good thing. It's a double-edged sword always for me. I think when the filmmaker is part of the movie, and she's clearly, you know, not deciding to go that way, and then eventually is
kind of pulled into
the movie itself, which is very interesting. But look, I think this is a really interesting movie about an interesting topic and interesting people in an interesting situation. And it's funny. It makes you laugh and it makes you tear up. And I feel like I spent time with this cute family.
Yeah, me too. Lovely stuff. It's so goddamn good-natured. I just felt like, oh.
But it's also an important story to tell, you know, because it kind of hits on the, in effect, you know, this whole thing of every vote counts. It doesn't get highly political, but clearly it conveys this message of a lot of what happens in society is very dependent upon the government that's in power at that time.
Right.
So it's during the Reagan era and then the Clinton era. So it's very interesting, even just that perspective.
And I think the other, I don't want to give too much of it, but the other perspective, which is fascinating, is how every one of us is so conflicted, and that's what makes us human. And her mother, as wonderful as she is, you know, she's been in this business for so long, but when things come pretty close to her in dealing with some of these issues, then her religious concerns kind of pop up almost, you know. In spite of her better judgment, but yeah,
brilliant document.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very, very good. It's showing up at Netflix. It's just a question of when they've acquired it. Yeah.
Terrific stuff. Great. And that's the other thing with film festivals is, you know, we will talk about these movies, but unless you participate in film festivals, oftentimes it's a frustrating thing for everyone in that you don't get to see them.
Correct.
So always great to hear that something's got picked up for some sort of release after the film festival. Excellent. Okay, move on then to our third movie of the day, which is the movie Run.
Yeah, so I will be introducing Run. So Run is directed by Scott Graham, and it's part of the narrative competition at the Tribeca Film Festival. And it's a British movie, and the story is as follows. In the northern Scottish town of Fraserburgh, young men dream of escapism through late-night drag races. Finney, played by Mark Stanley, used to be one such lad, but now he works at the fish factory, and it's his son's turn to dream and race. Until one night when Finney steals the boy's car for one last joyride. So this sounds
Fast and Furious.
Yeah. Mixed in a little bit, with the full Monty, maybe a little bit. I can see that as well. So, Joey, you were the only one who saw it. Tell us.
I was, yeah. Full Monty, no, it has no comedic elements to it. This is a kind of a grim and gritty portrayal of working class Northern Scotland. And, you know, one of the most remarkable things about the movie was when I stepped in there, it's an English language movie that has been subtitled. And at first I thought, you know, how offensive is that to an American audience that, you know, they felt the need to subtitle this, you know, very colloquial Scottish accent, until I got into about 5 minutes into the movie. And then I realized that, you know, even as somebody who has family based in Scotland, who visits Scotland on a semi-regular basis, and has picked up a couple of the statements and expressions that are used, I found this language here to be impenetrable at times. And, you know, you can understand what's said with the context of the subtitles, but, you know, for a time I forced myself not to read them, and I literally lost the plot, so I had to go back to reading them. So it is, you know, a very specific portrayal of a very specific town, and it's a small town Scotland, and it's a working class town. So, you know, these are people, you know, without grand jobs and grand lives. They work blue collar jobs, you know, they struggle day to day to kind of get by. And our main character here is somebody who's really having kind of a crisis with that. The movie Run is referenced, a reference to the Born to Run tattoo that he and his wife had done when they were growing up, as a, you know, a call out to that Bruce Springsteen song and album. And you know, here is somebody who has, you know, an older son at this point, and he looks at his life and he's saying, you know, why didn't I run? Why did we stay here? Why have we ended up where we were? So it kind of takes us through an evening in his life, and, you know, he has to kind of put some things together. He does take his son's car for a race and kind of relive some moments of his youth. But overall, I mean, I thought this movie, you know, despite its kind of initial bleak hopelessness, you know, was a kind of an interesting look into a kind of a midlife mental breakdown. I won't call it a full-on crisis, but certainly somebody who's reflecting over the choices that he's made and going through kind of a mental journey, assessing what he has versus where he wanted to be in life. And the angst is palpable. The performances are convincing. I think the movie's, you know, generally restrained and well-executed enough to really be worth recommending. You know, its morals and its ultimate parable, I think, are a little confused. I think, you know, it doesn't ultimately satisfy in terms of, you know, taking us on a journey. You know, these typical movies kind of take us through like the redemption character curve, and this doesn't give us that level of satisfaction. But nonetheless, it feels very real in the moment, and you know, I kind of enjoyed spending a little time in this environment, and felt myself kind of relieved for getting out of it as well. So yeah, that was Run, and genuinely a recommendation. Okay, moving on then to our next movie, which is the movie Armis, which also goes by the name Ravening, which I don't think is in our show notes here, but I did look at the movie's IMDb page, and they refer to it as Ravening.
So that's the English title.
Okay. So who's going to tell us about Armis?
Yeah, so Armis is a movie set in Assam in northern India, and it tells the story of a woman who's a doctor who is one day brought into check up on somebody who has eaten too much and gorged, and this man's friend has brought her in to help his friend. And then this kind of friendship builds between this somewhat younger man and this female doctor who is married, and it starts from a very innocent, innocuous meeting where the man kind of introduces her to cooking, which is done using meats which are freshly obtained. So nothing you know, processed or frozen or any such thing.
The Meat Club.
The Meat Club.
Hipstery.
Yeah, quite hipstery. And essentially, their friendship grows, initially very platonic level, as he goes about introducing her to more and more niche kind of meats, until kind of the movie kind of, you know, asks the question, how far can this relationship go in terms of all kinds of, you know, what's a transgression, what's taboo, what's, you know, she's obviously an older married woman, he's a younger man. And it kind of asks some very interesting questions as it moves along. So on the face of it, kind of a romantic fable, but it has a few tricks down its sleeve. And we all saw this, up its sleeve, sorry, not down its sleeve.
And we should definitely say we're going to be very careful here to avoid spoilers. I think this movie is very easily spoiled, so we need to kind of step around some of the key plot elements here, but that was a very nicely handled introduction.
Go on.
No, I lost my notes here, so I had to do it ad hoc, so I was being very careful.
So I think this felt very reminiscent in feeling, and as we were walking out of the cinema, of The Lunchbox, right? Unfolds and it's a slow burn, and you're just watching this beautiful relationship develop. And then all I'll say is, I found the last hour unbearable.
Okay.
Like it just, I don't even want to say much more.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, just to kind of add to that, I think I didn't find it unbearable, actually. I found it curiouser and curiouser. So, I mean, this is quite the directorial accomplishment here, right? Because I think the movie spends its time kind of setting up a movie that is not ultimately the movie that you end up leaving seeing. And so, you know, if you're interested in more about that, I would take a look at some of the categorizations of genre that this movie is placed into. If you look at IMDb profiles and other areas on the web, but again, that might be saying a little bit more than one should. But I think it provides adequate foresight for those of us, because you know the reality here is that this movie isn't going to be for everyone. And, you know, I'm not sure that it's for anyone. I loved it. I'll say that right off the bat. But it does explore some very dark themes. I think that's all I'll say there. And I love the fact that it kept me on my toes, and it took me to places that I wasn't expecting it to. And it did so in a way that I felt was plausible. You know,
in its universe,
within the context of it, and it also allowed us time to get there, because you know, had it done it in a different way, I think the movie's impact would have been quite different. So I actually think it was very, very well handled from a directorial perspective.
Yeah, and I don't want to make out like I hated the movie. I just found the last hour unbearable because of what happens.
Okay.
And it made me very uncomfortable. Let's put it that way. I didn't hate the movie. I just was thinking, like, this is a complete 180.
Yeah, Steve, I'm dying to hear what you thought of this.
No, I absolutely loved it as well. In my notes, I wrote, where is this movie going? Like, do they like each other? Do they love each other or not? Because it kind of is constantly playing this back and forth where you're not really clear whether she is romantically interested in this younger man or not. It's not really clear about his intentions, because he, at one point, Googles platonic love. So he seems to initially at least want it to only be a friendship, but then he understands the constraints with getting physical. And I think the movie, if it's nothing else, it's a great exercise in control over tone, because it starts from very, very believable naturalist elements and very, very, very slowly, you know, kind of reveals itself. And then when it turns on a dime, it's that much more effective, because you're like, that's not the movie I sat for. That's not the movie I signed up for. But at the same time, it's so unexpected that it made me giddy. And it made you uncomfortable. I almost found it darkly humorous, because from that point onwards, it almost became like a dark,
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Like a fable. It became like almost a parable to me, because it was kind of metaphorical for me at that point.
I was going to add, so I wrote down three metaphors: loss of innocence, mm-hmm. sins of the flesh, and sacrifice.
So I think it started touch, and it's amazing that this movie is only the Sophomore attempt from this particular director. So
how interesting.
Yeah, it's only his second movie. And I was so unprepared for it, and I was just so happy that where I was so not seeing it. And I think I was the only one in the audience who was laughing at a few points.
No, there was a lot of laughter with some of them. Yeah. I have to say, I mean, Assam looks beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's filmed in Assam, right? I mean, Assam is, we hear so little of it other than the tea. But the place looks stunning. I mean, so green and lush, and the type of people who are walking around. It looks really interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the movie itself is unsettling because of its, you know, essential normalcy, I think is the American word for that. But, and again, I think we buy its ultimate premise because it takes its time to set up the world and the universe and the relationships and the actions of the characters are ultimately plausible because we've taken our time to get there and understand the nature of the relationship that they have. So I thought this was terrific.
Yeah, I loved it too.
I find it hard to recommend this universally because I think some people will struggle with this, but I think anyone, again, I think if you listen to this podcast and you have a love of film and you have an open mind,
and you want to be challenged.
Let's just say you'll have plenty to talk about after you watch this movie.
For sure.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I worry about the commercial success of this.
I mean, there was some...
Just to finish my point, I would imagine that this is the kind of movie that, for example, my parents might put on Netflix because it has a very romantic premise and it's a kind of movie that Lunchbox fans might start watching and then ultimately find themselves in different territory. And there were walkouts. I don't know whether they were logistical walkouts or whether they were thematic walkouts.
Like, I'm done with this, is so weird.
But good stuff.
Okay, final movie of the evening
is A Taste of Sky.
Okay, so this is a documentary directed by Michael Yuchen Lee, and it's about one of my heroes, Klaus Meyer, who was he's basically a culinary entrepreneur, most famously known for the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen. He's actually kickstarted a gastronomic revolution in Bolivia's capital of La Paz, and he's opened up a restaurant called Gustu, which is a fine dining restaurant and cooking school for the country's impoverished youth. So this really follows a few of the students there and their experiences, and really kind of pulls back the curtain on Klaus Meyer himself, as he has quite a revealing conversation with his younger, articulate, amazing daughter. So we all saw this one.
And if I might just interject there, Ashmeet, so the restaurant Noma, for those people that don't know, is has been on multiple occasions considered to be the world's best restaurant. So, this is a fine dining entrepreneur that really understands the world of food. And
Noma's thing is that the restaurant owners or the chefs, whoever, they go foraging and they find whatever is available locally, off the land, off the immediate local culture, and prepare foods based on that. So there's nothing fixed on the menu and so forth. And that's kind of his philosophy. Yeah.
I'll go first, I mean, with my thoughts. It was great. This was done with this is the world premiere that we attended. This is one of the ticketed presentations that we went to, and we had the filmmaker present for a Q&A at the end. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how the movie came about. He didn't really have this grand plan to make this movie, but he went for a meal at the restaurant in Bolivia, La Paz, Bolivia, and unveiled that there was this very interesting social experiment going on there. And I think you know, what he's done over time is he's followed the restaurant. He's picked a couple of people from the restaurant's you know, apprenticeships or you know, staff, and followed them. And you know, look, the movie is extremely beautifully shot and edited. There's this very almost ethereal feel to much of it. I mean, a lot of it is talking heads, but there's also this very kind of dreamy music that plays through, and there's a lot of beauty in terms of how the movie has been put together. I did feel that maybe narratively it could have been a little stronger in places, because you know, it does kind of jump around from kind of, you know, visual to visual. But you know, again, I think it's a very it's a very engaging, you know, visual movie, and it's a very important topic that the movie talks about, which is, you know, poverty and bringing people up, and you know, the importance of food within culture, the importance, you know, philanthropy to some extent. So, yeah, I like this one.
Yes, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I truly appreciated this film, and like you, from both perspectives. I mean, visually the movie is just incredible. I mean, there are many scenes in the movie of just one or two people in the middle of this giant wilderness as they're trying to find, as they're foraging for the right foods, you know, unusual foods, and so gorgeously filmed. It almost looks like something out of a National Geographic special. It's just gorgeous to look at. But I think what I admire the movie more, even more for, is its depiction of what is right in the world right now. I mean, there's a lot which is going on, which is horrible. And we are, as a species, moving further and further away from each other and looking to find our differences. And, you know, I think for those who come into uncommon wealth or fame and fortune, very often they're at a loss. Like, after you've achieved everything, after you're at the top of your field, what do you do? And most people kind of settle down, or they, you know, rest on their laurels, or they
buy another jet
or a yacht or whatever. And then there are other people like Klaus Meyer, who, you know, uses his fame. You know, he has restaurants which are considered the best in Europe, and yet he chose to go to Bolivia to set up a fine dining restaurant in a very developing country that doubles as a school of gastronomy for underprivileged youth. And it's a giant social experiment. It's something which could have completely failed. And he invested himself. He moved his whole family there, and he started this whole program, which has clearly, I mean, started almost a village, the way, you know, we find out about what's happened. So I'm just amazed that it tells the story of what an individual can do in terms of good. And there is three characters, three underprivileged kids from Bolivia that the movie kind of follows. And each of their stories are done with a lot of honesty, and it never felt pandering or never felt like he was putting anybody at a pedestal. So I really enjoyed the movie for its depiction of social good.
I agree with what you said, and I think the one sentence that I kept hearing throughout the film was the power of food to change the world. Mm-hmm. And I took that both to mean the ability of sharing flavors to welcome someone into your country, as well as being able to provide food to those that don't have it, i.e. these people who are born and raised in poverty. So I think from both those perspectives, it kind of is a great documentary. And I think I like what this guy's doing. And later during the Q&A, we learned that he's actually doing something in New York, in East Brooklyn, which is also an underserved area, and more impoverished than the rest of New York. And so I kind of love this idea that this guy can basically go anywhere, name his price, and open up a restaurant. But he also recognizes that if he does it in the right places, the people will come.
He can change
lives. And by the people coming, it will change the world. And that's apparently what's happened in La Paz. So since he started this experiment, it's not only changed the lives of these people, but the alumni have gone to move on and develop their own country, which I love. So I think it's got some beautiful themes in here. I agree with you. A stronger narrative would have been nice. I would have wanted to know what the kids did to earn their place at Gusto, what their experiences were of going through cooking school. But that's a different documentary, I think. This is much more ethereal and more of a feeling than a linear narrative.
Yeah, and two other things I want to mention. One is that Klaus Meyer, during the course of the movie, is interviewed by his own daughter, who looks all of, 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah, and she couldn't have been older than 11.
Or 11 at the most. And she asks him the most wonderful, insightful, detailed questions.
She's an old soul.
So impressed. Yeah, she's an old soul.
And it sounds like he himself had quite a difficult childhood and is a product of someone doing this for him. So he's kind of paying it forward, it felt like.
I mean, there's a wonderful line that he says is that he believes in the philosophy of planting a seed, knowing fully well that the fruits won't bear during your lifetime, but it is the next generation which will benefit from the fruit of what you have seeded right now, which is a beautiful, beautiful concept. And, you know, we can all smile right now sitting in this table and think about it, but to leave something for posterity, for the next generation, is a wonderful legacy to leave behind. And he's thought about it and already put it into practice. And I think the second thing which I really liked is that there is a global scourge right now where the West is really influencing and taking over the cuisines in the rest of the world, where, you know, everybody loves pizza and hamburgers and, you know, McDonald's everywhere.
French food has an outsized influence outside of France.
And I think I really like the idea that again, Klaus Meyer is perpetuating, which is that if you are opening a restaurant in Bolivia, then you don't need to, you know, serve French food there. You could be inspired by it, but you need to learn from the local cultures there and what's available there and kind of make a fine dining experience out of that immediate local culture, which is, again, a beautiful concept. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of propagating that. And there are wonderful scenes of, you know, people going to get this, you know, this very rare kind of palm. I can't even explain. Yeah, the kernel of
palmito, I think.
Yeah, the palmito, you know, which is, you know, looks delicious. You know, you cut it up and then you make little straws out of it. Crocodile meat, mushrooms, wild mushrooms, and so forth. So yeah,
certain types of fruits and flowers that
fish,
are just
the fish.
Yeah, fish, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, no, that
good
was
good. We didn't before we saw that.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. And then we went and ate some more afterwards. So that's quite the effect it had on all of us. So, yeah, let's wrap up for today. So again, let us know what you thought of the podcast. If you are listening this far, we really appreciate it. You can find us at facebook.com/moviewallahs, instagram.com/moviewallahs, twitter.com/moviewallahs. And we are trying to do periodic updates on all of those platforms throughout the film fest. So do check those out. And I guess we will call the podcast today to an end. We'll have at least one or more podcasts from the festival. We're here for a couple more days. And like I said on the previous podcast, if you are in the New York, New Jersey, tri-state area, if you can get yourself some time to New York before May the 5th, I think, which is when the festival ends, please do so. Some of the films that we're talking about, we got to see as press previews, so they are available as public screenings if you're listening live, and please do do check them out. They're a good time at the movies. So support your local film fests. Okay, until tomorrow. Too many movies, too little time. A good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.